Hello, I am Kimberly Adams. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rosendahl. It's Tuesday. One topic in the news, especially in the news today, are the hearings of the January 6th committee on Capitol Hill. We've been talking about it for a while, but we're going to talk about it a little more today because this is, for my money, the story. It is the story for the next, I don't even know how long. Anyway, that's what we're going to do today.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about this with someone who's been focusing on the aftermath of January 6th, not just these hearings, but he's been following all the court cases as they've been working their way through the system, the developments on the Hill and everywhere else. My buddy Kyle Chaney, who's a senior legal affairs reporter at Politico. We go way back to the State House News Service in Boston. Kyle, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you both for having me.
So as somebody who has been following the sort of nuances and every single legal filing, every single court case, like all the way through this process, I imagine there hasn't been much new for you two hearings in. But what has struck you so far about these hearings?
You know, actually, you'd be surprised that you're right. And the broad arc of the story of what we know has not changed all that much. I mean, Donald Trump was impeached in February 2021, and the story that led to his impeachment has been largely unchanged, but they've filled in so many of the details about what was happening inside the West Wing, what was happening, you know, behind the scenes at the Justice Department, that it tells a much more vivid and much more unnerving story than even what we learned during impeachment. So what the committee did in the first two hearings that I thought was fairly effective was they put they took video depositions with a lot of these witnesses. These are people in Donald Trump's inner circle involved in all of the key moments of his attempt to subvert the election. And you saw them in their own words saying what happened. And it was not a flattering story for Donald Trump. And so it felt more credible. It felt more compelling to hear it from the mouths of the witnesses themselves.
The committee is trying, obviously, to get all of this on the record, right? Doing the democratically, small d, responsible thing and getting all of this on the record. Rather than ask, do you think they're going to change anybody's mind, let me ask you this. Do you think they're trying to change people's minds?
You know, this is a great question because I've been asking them, you know, what is the goal of these hearings? What do you want at the end of all this to know whether you succeeded or not? And you kind of get a few different answers. One is that, yes, can we marshal public opinion to agree that what happened was wrong at a basic mm-hmm. level and a threat to democracy and that we should all try to prevent it from ever happening again? That's one answer. One is just to preserve this for history. To make sure, you know, you can't have an insurrection on the Capitol and not investigate it to the fullest extent possible. It's just not imaginable. And then it's to show, you know, that people like Donald Trump and in his orbit don't belong anywhere near the levers of power again. And they want people to sort of come to general agreement on that. You know, I don't know if they think they're going to get through to, you know, the diehard Trump, loyalist, faithful that will walk through fire for him. But I think maybe they believe there's some group that has sort of lost interest or hadn't followed every nuance of this for the last year and a half that can be awakened to all the details they're about to unload on the public.
What about in terms of actual sort of concrete outcomes from either a legal or criminal perspective? Are they leading up to something that is going to change anything?
Well, you know, look, it's twofold, actually. Yes, there's the criminal process, which is playing out. Justice Department is still, you know, focused primarily on people who broke into the Capitol on January 6th and attacked police. But they started to look a little more closely at Donald Trump's circle, the people in sort of the outer rungs of the Trump orbit, and suggesting that maybe they're moving a little closer every day, every week. But then there's also the policy outcome, which the committee is ostensibly focused on, which is how do we change the laws that were exploited by people in Donald Trump's orbit to ensure that what happened can never happen again? How do we shore up Capitol security, and intelligence gathering and sharing, monitor things like domestic extremism, which had such a big part in the violence at the Capitol? And so that, I think we may see legislative recommendations sometime this fall.
So you follow this on a granular level, right? And thank God for that, because you're keeping us informed, of which I am one of your readers, right? But look, there are millions of people in this country. Forget the slice of the Republican base that is Donald Trump's now and forever. But there is a slice of the population in this country that, while aware of these hearings, is saying, are you kidding me? Inflation's 8.6%. I got to pay $5.50 for a gallon of gas. My food is costing me $400 a week. How am I supposed to pay attention to this? Make that case.
You know, I think the committee acknowledges that. I think they have never, said that this is somehow a replacement for policy solutions in those areas that have more direct impact on people's lives. I think what they want to show here, or what they would argue, and what I've heard them argue, is if you don't have a functioning democracy, if the system itself fails and you have an autocracy, or you have something that isn't the current representative democracy that we have, all those other issues go out the window. You need that as a baseline to even confront the economic and policy issues that matter in people's lives. They want people to remember that this is real for them too. And I think that's part of the point here, is people don't view this as connected to their lives. They don't view this as something that's directly related to them because it happened 17 months ago, and they don't necessarily see it as impacting the future. But the committee wants them to understand that not only did this happen and it was bad, it's ongoing. There's still a threat to the country, still a threat to democracy here, and that if you do care about the economy, you need to make sure that we have a functioning government to confront those problems in the future too.
Since you have been following this so closely, and like Kai said, at this granular level, how close were we to having a coup on January 6th?
Extraordinarily close. And I think that's one of the takeaways the committee is trying to convey, is that this was a lot closer than even people realized over the course of this. There were a couple of key moments, a couple of key decisions by officials in power to push back. And that may have made the difference between this succeeding or not. This was, if any state legislatures had decided to try to put an alternative, a pro-Trump slate in and sent it to Congress, that could have been the thing that pushed it across the finish line. If Mike Pence had not resisted the pressure campaign from Donald Trump and tried to do what Donald Trump wanted, if people at the Justice Department didn't threaten to resign en masse, if Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger agreed to, quote, find, unquote, the votes that Trump said he needed him to find, at any of those points, we could be talking about a different outcome. And the committee wants to make that as clear to the people as possible.
So now what? We've got, four hearings left. They are laying out this 7-step narrative that Congresswoman Cheney laid out in that first primetime hearing. Where do we go from here?
So I expect we're going to hear more. I mean, so far, the first couple of hearings, we've heard about the overview, the broad contours of the effort, Donald Trump's effort, and how that led to the violent attack on the Capitol. And we've heard sort of how he seeded what they call the big lie, the false and the lies about the election results, and how that became the foundation for everything else that came next, the attempt to overturn the election. I think we're going to start to hear more about what all the pieces I just mentioned, what was going on inside the Justice Department, where Trump threatened to replace the entire leadership so that they would use the powers of government to overturn the election. What was happening in the pressure campaign against Mike Pence. I want to get into the real details of, how Trump, got a team of lawyers led by John Eastman, who essentially tried to legitimize this effort to overturn the election on January 6th when Congress was counting electoral votes. I think we're going to see a much deeper dive into each of those facets. There's going to be some stuff on the money trail and how Republican fundraising ended up financing Trump's January 6th rally, and how that was just very murky and potentially crossed into
grifty
criminal territory. So I think there's just several lanes here that the committee is going to hit one at a time to try to provide more detail than we've seen so far.
Kyle Cheney is a senior legal affairs reporter at Politico. If you don't follow him on the Twitter or read his stuff in Politico, you're missing on the details because he's doing unbelievable work. Kyle, thanks so much. I really appreciate your time.
Of course. Great to be here.
Bye, Kyle.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Oof,
good stuff.
Boy.
Good in a terrible way, but good stuff.
Good that we're finding out.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think, you know, when I'm talking to my friends and family back home and trying to convince them to watch these hearings, it's hard to explain to people what it felt like to be in D.C. on that day.
Yeah.
I had my phone and everything off because I was on vacation and trying to unplug, and all of a sudden, you know, there are like armored vehicles rushing down the streets everywhere. There are, you know, the city shuts down. There are guys waving giant Confederate flags and Trump flags outside the grocery store in my neighborhood and claiming that they're getting ready to take over. It was so close. I was on BBC a couple months ago with somebody in Texas who was saying that it wasn't that big of a deal and it was just a DC story and it didn't really matter. And I was just like, oh my gosh, it's this idea that the counter narrative has been so powerful in diminishing how serious this was. And even if the only takeaway of these hearings is to get people aware of how close we were, I think that's a potential win.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. All right. Well, let us know what you think. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART. If you have questions, if you have thoughts, maybe if you want to tell us how you felt on that day when you saw all this going down from wherever you were. You can send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we'll be right back.
All right, time for the news. Ms. Adams, you go first.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if we're talking about extremism and nationalism, we can't do it without talking about this wild story out of Idaho.
Wild and horrifying. Terrible. Unbelievable.
Wild and horrifying, where 31 people were arrested as they were getting ready to attack a pride celebration. And these guys were in uniform, they had on masks, they were armed, and they had an organized plan to basically attack en masse this pride celebration. And, you know, this is the Patriot Front. It's a white nationalist group. It's a group that's been involved in other crimes. The guy who drove a car into a crowd of protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia.
He was
affiliated with the original Patriot Front. And a lot of these people have ties to what happened on January 6th. And the rising tide of white nationalism and domestic extremism in the United States is so dangerous. And there's a story in the AP that is talking about where the hate speech targeting LGBTQ people across the country and all of these laws and pending legislation targeting LGBTQ folks with such hostile language and perpetuating these stigmas and discrimination is actually galvanizing some of these far-right influencers and extremist groups. And that's what leads to it. And all the people who watch these extremist groups and how they talk to each other online, they're using this language as leverage for organizing these kinds of things. And so rhetoric is not without consequences. And so these lawmakers who are throwing out this really incendiary and hurtful and harmful language about LGBTQ folks in the media around this legislation, like, it's in the hearings, we're seeing how Donald Trump's language about a stolen election, even though it was false, directly galvanized people to attack the Capitol. And now we are seeing where this incendiary language against LGBTQ folks is directly galvanizing people to attack them. And this is what is happening. And it's extraordinarily dangerous.
The thing that gets me about this story, in addition to everything you said, was that the sheriff or the local authorities up there said it was only because a concerned citizen saw them loading these 31 guys into the back of a U-Haul that said, something's not right here. This looks like an army, I think is what the person said, and called the cops. That's the only reason this didn't get unbelievably ugly.
Yeah. That was one of my two stories. The other one is just an observation of, let's just say, a little bit of a policy disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
So the CDC recently lifted the testing requirements to enter the country internationally because they made the assessment, or the agency made the assessment, that it's no longer necessary in the pandemic to test international travelers coming into the United States. However, I should note that, and I'm just going to read here from the Kaiser Family Foundation's description of this, Title 42 of the Public Health Services Act is a public health authority that authorizes the director of the Centers for Disease Control to suspend entry of individuals into the U.S. to protect public health. This authority was implemented by the Trump administration in March 2020 in response to the COVID-19 pandemic to allow for the quick expulsion of migrants, including asylum seekers seeking entry to the U.S. at land borders. So, apparently the pandemic has receded enough, even though it hasn't, to allow people that who have not been tested to enter the United States if you come on a plane, but if you come by land seeking asylum or are a migrant, our same agency is still under the stance that they are not allowed. Now, granted, the Biden administration has attempted to roll this back, and it has been blocked by a court. But that is just how things stand. That's all I got.
Fair enough. Mine is nowhere near any of those two policy issues. It's just the observation that crypto winter is upon us. Coinbase, the granddaddy of the crypto exchanges, announced today it's laying off 18% of its people. The CEO, Brian Armstrong, in making the announcement said, we overhired, in essence, which prompted me to look for how many people Coinbase employs. 4,900 people, almost 5,000 people at Coinbase,
wow.
which blew me away. That's a lot of people to help people move crypto around. It's just an indicator of, number one, the volatility of crypto, how it has real-world impacts, and, oh, by the way, CEOs are starting to say to themselves, in addition to crypto CEOs, are saying, this economy could get shaky in a hurry, and we're going to lay some people off. So there you go.
Yeah, and I was reading that they shut off everybody's like email access right before.
It was really bad.
It's such an ugly way to do people.
It was really bad. Yeah. So apparently what they did was they emailed people to their personal email addresses because they had already cut off their corporate email addresses, letting them know that they were fired. It was wild.
That is just such a dirty way to do people. Yeah. Like if somebody hasn't actively threaten that they're going to do something awful to you. That's just not a nice way to do it.
Let's always remember, people, that HR works for the company. HR does not work for you. HR works for the company. Yeah. Anywho.
Yeah.
Let's do some mailbag stuff.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
We talked housing last week with the one, the only Amy Scott, and here is voice memo number one.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly. This is Alejandra from Houston. Although I feel a lot of pressure from Gen Xers around me about the importance of buying a house and building equity, there are several reasons why I struggle with the idea. One, I want to live in the city where houses around me are about $1.5 million for 1,300 square feet. I don't want to be responsible for a place that could flood or have pipes burst during an epic winter freeze because of our ongoing climate crisis, and I don't want to deal with maintenance. So I pay a fortune to live in a popular part of the city. I can't bring myself to look at houses in the suburbs where everyone is married with kids, but houses are more affordable. I guess my dog will have to wait a little bit longer for a yard. Thanks for making me smart.
And that is why I live in a condo with maintenance included.
Yeah. All of that is true. Maintenance is terrible. All of that is true. I can't argue with a thing Alejandra said at all.
Yeah, but also the prices of housing in you know, urban areas where, you know, it's a fun place to live, you know, are ridiculous. Like the place where I bought my home, I could not afford to buy here now. I could afford to buy when I did, but I absolutely could not afford to buy here now. And that is becoming more and more of a reality for folks, that housing isn't just expensive, it's unattainable. And the higher these rents are going, the more unattainable it is, because you can't save anything. And, you know, if I hear one more person talk about, oh, just stop your streaming services and, you know, don't get your lattes and, you know, stop taking Ubers and walk, it's like, is that going to net me $1.5 million in savings? I'm sorry. No, it's not going to do it. And so, yeah, I feel your pain, and I have no idea how to fix it. Nope. I don't know.
Nope.
All right. We also got an email from Lori in response to Taco Bell ditching dining rooms in exchange for drive-through lanes. Lori says, I'm sad to hear about Taco Bell's switch to no dining rooms. In a rural county where I lived before moving to Renton, Washington, Taco Bell and McDonald's were the gathering places for the senior citizens while they waited for the senior center, which I ran for 30 years, to open, since we didn't serve breakfast. They were inexpensive, welcoming places for single seniors to gather and chat. That is a really good point.
It's a great point, and it's kind of a sad point, too, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, because in so many places, when there aren't a lot of, unlike where Alejandra lives, where there is not a lot of restaurants and places to hang out and community spaces, yeah, like the McDonald's with the kids' place, what do they call those areas?
Kids' space. McDonald's. No, that's a museum.
Kids' space?
I don't even know. Play place.
I'm sure it's something
whatever.
Brand.
We all know what we're talking about.
You know, the having those spaces is so important. Like, I definitely remember as a kid being excited about going to play on the little thing at McDonald's. More excited about that than the food.
That's right. Sorry to interrupt. Here's the parent of the toddler in the Slack, Bridget Bonner. Play Place is what they're called.
Thank you, Bridget.
Yeah, I knew she'd know. I knew she'd know. All right. Before we go, as we always do, this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question. This is the Father's Day edition, which, oh, by the way, is this weekend. What is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about?
Oh, here's a nice surprise. Today's answer comes from former Marketplace tech editor and recently new dad, Michael Lipkin.
Something I thought I knew but later found out that I was wrong about was how much self-worth I could get outside of work. A lot of people probably already know that about themselves, but I didn't. I was one of those people who, for a long time, what I did and where I worked were the things that defined me. I had hobbies I was passionate about and family I loved, but just what I did for work gave me a lot of purpose. And then my wife gave birth, and we have an amazing son, and I took 6 months to be with him, and it was hard. And I realized that if I became independently wealthy, or really, if childcare gets even $1 more expensive, I realized that I would be so happy as a stay-at-home parent. Work just doesn't matter as much in a profound way. Thanks for all you do keeping us smart.
Oh, Michael. Lovely little note. What a lovely
so
little note.
That's sweet.
That's,
and by the way, I am blessed to get a steady stream of baby photos of that gorgeous child, and they bring me great joy.
Yeah. Oh, that was a nice, nice note, Michael. Thank you so much. So
and
keep sending us
your
answers.
Happy early Father's Day to you.
That's
too,
right.
Kai.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Although my kids now are, you know, no longer the little bundles of joy. Let me just say that. Anyway, love my kids, though I do. Keep sending us your answers to that Make Me Smart question via voice memo to our email at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us a message, 508-827-6278. 508-UB-SMART is what that works out to.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our intern is Olivia Zhao, and Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter.
Today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado. Mingxin Xiguan is going to mix it down later. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer of this podcast is Bridget Bonner. Nana Tam is the director of On Demand. I got it right this time, Donna, although I messed it up a little bit. Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough. There we go.
This is like nostalgia episode today. Yeah. Got Kyle Chaney, Michael Lipkin. Good times.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.